very knowledgeable baseball man. He was very well conditioned. He tried to help everybody, all the players, try to teach him. He did great things. He did good things for Mike Schmidt. He did a lot of good things for Greg Luzinski, Larry Boa, Gary Maddox, Big McBride, guys like that that I had on my team. He missed spring. I don't know if he missed spring training as much as maybe he missed some ball games later on in his career, but he never missed a game for me. I think he was probably misunderstood by a lot of people.
Well, he certainly was controversial as an understatement. And you think a lot of that was just press trying to blow up something to make something colorful out of...
Well, I think it all happened with that
accident.
Because
sometimes he could have an abusive tongue.
Yeah, I think it all happened, you know, with that accident he had in Philadelphia when he was playing and he was pushing a car and he put his hand through the headlight.
Tore up his hand.
Yeah, and then he couldn't throw the ball because he was a third baseman, and they moved him to the outfield a little bit, and then he put him back at first base and so on. But I think a lot of the things, you know, off the field, they got into some of that. They had a player by the name of Larry Heisel, who he tried to protect. Really crucified him, and Larry became a good ball player later on when he went to Milwaukee as an outfielder. If there was anything controversial, I think that he was kind of protective of other people.
Oh, really?
And,
so he got a few darts and swords thrown at him because he...
He did things, you know, that maybe he shouldn't have done, but he played. He played regardless. I don't think he ever shunned away from playing. I don't think there's anybody that he ever played for said, hey, he just said he wouldn't play. When I got him in Philadelphia, he had no spring training. He came out to the ballpark where we were on the road, and he took some batting practice and ground balls, whatever. I never saw this because we were on the road playing games. We got back. He gets into the lineup, and the very first time at bat, he gets a base hit. And 50,000 people in the stands go wild. The fans love him. He was on that 76 team when we won that thing. And he was fine. He was with me. He was with the Los Angeles Dodgers when I was coaching there. And that's my first time I met Dick Allen, and we became pretty good friends, and he didn't give any, he wouldn't give any interviews.
Yeah, he'd play that lonely. He'd be like Steve Carlton on the press.
Yeah, he just wouldn't do it. And
what, he felt he was abused by them and misquoted, or
I
just
never,
didn't trust him?
I never bothered. I think Bobby was trusted more than anything. But I got to know him very well there, and I think there at one time, this was in 72 probably, or maybe, I can't remember what year, 71, 72, somewhere there, when he was with us. He finally did give an interview with Vince Scully, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And only because of persistence of Walter O'Malley.
Mm-hmm.
I think Walter O'Malley called him in. Yeah, they had the interview, but I think it might have been the only one all year.
Yeah.
But he was kind of, you know, by himself. The best friend he had on the team when he was with me in Philadelphia was Tony Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
Tony was not his watchdog or anything, but he was his best friend because they had played together in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Before that.
Yeah.
And he liked Tony, and Tony liked him, and I got to Tony was. Like I said, I knew Tony very well, not only for his playing ability, but because of his association with the Latin players.
Mm-hmm.
He could understand some of those things.
Well, Dick Allen got involved also with when Curt Flood challenged the reserve clause.
Yeah.
And I think he stayed out, didn't he, and was very outspoken in defense of Curt Flood.
Well, I think, you know, yeah, he probably, well, undoubtedly, that's the truth there. I think he protected a lot of the black players,
mm-hmm.
or he tried to.
Yes.
You know, because he felt like, you know, a lot of them were not getting a fair shake, I guess, and things happened. And at that time, you know, when he was playing enough in Philly, Bob Carpenter and the Carpenters just admired this guy. They loved him.
Oh, really?
Oh.
You know, Willie
Carpenter to this day likes him, hmm. and always will like him.
What's Dick Allen doing now?
I think he's got a part. From what I had read, I haven't heard. The last time I saw him was in Los Angeles, I think, when we played an old-timer game. But I saw something in the paper. I thought that he had bought part of the Churchill Downs in Kentucky, or he was involved in the purchase of that.
Uh-huh.
His brother Hank, who was a ball player also.
Uh-huh.
Hank is a trainer, horse trainer, thoroughbred trainer. And I think he's in Laurel in Maryland. And in fact, he had a horse running in the Kentucky Derby. Might have been the only one ever to have one run in there. But and Dick Allen was, you know, a thoroughbred. He loved thoroughbred horses. Mm-hmm. He had quite a few of those, too. Mm-hmm. And
so he's in the...
So I think he's...
Doing
I had read something now. Whether it's the truth or not, I don't know. But I did see something in the paper saying that he was going to buy or part interest in Churchill Downs.
Returning to the Dodgers, you came up with them in 64, won a World Series.
65.
65, I'm sorry. That was against the Minnesota Twins.
Yes.
When you were down, they won the first two games.
Yes.
Now, you had a fantastic pitching core.
Yeah,
now, most of us think of Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale, but lesser known, the one that really was a mainstay was Claude Alstein.
Claude Alstein, that's right. Yeah.
And he kind of turned that World Series around.
He certainly did. He certainly did. He came in there and pitched a couple good ball games. And Claude, you know, when we got him, he was, in fact, of all the players we traded to Washington, to Claude Alstein, a lot of them played for me in Spokane, or maybe even in Omaha. And I was manager, Dick Nennan, Joe Moeller, not Joe Moeller, but Phil Ortega, Dick Nennan, I think I mentioned him, and then, you know, Frank Hard went there. But Claude came over, and he was a control pitcher. You know, velocity was not...
He was kind of like an Eddie Lopez, wasn't he, a jump pitcher?
Yeah. And he'd win a ball game, give up 10 hits, and win 2-1 or 1-0 or whatever. And I can remember many games that he pitched in Houston against the Astros, you know, when they had the Jimmy Wynn and all those right-handed power hitters. And we leave the ballpark, and you look up at the scoreboard, and it'd say, he gave up 12 hits. No home runs, you know, 23 or 24 ground balls.
kept the infield on his toes.
But, he was very instrumental, and I think he was about a 500 pitcher, which you need in to win a pennant, because Koufax won his 25 or whatever it was, and Drysdale won his big games. But he helped a lot. But the game that the seventh game of that World Series is when Sandy Koufax came back and pitched with 2 days rest.
That's right, and shut out the Twins, if I remember correctly. Was it
2-0? 2-1, or maybe it's 2-0. I can't remember that, but
yeah, I think he beat shut out the Twins.
That guy showed me intestinal fortitude. I don't know what you want to call it. Instinct. I don't know if he knew where the ball was really going half the time, because his hat would fall off. He would try and throw so hard. Turning point in that ball game was a Jim Gilliam play at third base, where he backhanded a sure double, tagged third, and I think Sergio Versailles hit that ball. And then there were some outstanding plays in that game. Left fielder, Allison.
Yeah, Bob Allison, yes.
Made a diving catch of a fly ball down the left field line in foul territory. Tony Oliva hit the ball. Killebrew was, you know, one of the big guns back then. Hall of Famer, outstanding person.
Yeah, a lot of Hall of Famers in that World Series.
Yes, yes, very much.
Some
couple of them didn't make it. Jim Cott didn't make it. Bud Kent Grant didn't make it. Gosh, you know, you look back then and say the Minnesota Twins. You don't remember, but they had some ballplayers on that team. For
they,
God's
had some,
wow.
They had some Meatpackers, Versalles, Allison, Killebrew, Olivia. I mean, they could whack that ball. Oliva could really whack that game out, that ball out of there.
Almost the thing that I see almost every year, I see a player that I thought was a dead man in that World Series. Earl Batty. Going after a pop fly in foul territory toward the dugout and hits the screen, which was neck high, and hit him right in the throat. And he hit that thing. And lost his voice and everything else. And we thought, I mean, you know, it just crushed him. But he did come back and play. But an outstanding person. Lives in Orlando. I see him in old-timer games. Just a great guy. Just a great guy. He's teaching, I think he's a phys ed at one of the high schools. You know, you think back to these things, and we talk about it now. We're sitting on a bench, and we're playing these five-inning games. You know, nobody can run, nobody can throw. And we're having fun, and they say, gee, you remember that? And remember this, and you remember all this other stuff.
Did Austin bring in Koufax and say, hey, I don't have anybody else that can do it, and he's got to go in? 2 days rest, I mean.
No, you know, this is a funny thing. I was a very close friend of Walter Austin's, not along with a lot of other people. But this is the end of this is after the sixth game.
Okay.
3-3, we're tied. And Lefty Phillips is the pitching coach. And we're sitting there, and who are we going to pitch tomorrow? And Lefty says, I think Koufax could pitch. And Waller says, in this real nice, who in the hell's going to ask him? Who's going to ask him? Just looking around, so I said, I'll go ask him.
You said that?
Yeah. I said, I'll go ask him if he'll pitch. So I walked up to his locker, and he looks up, and he says, what do you want? And I says, can you pitch tomorrow? And he says, who's asking? I says, 30 of the guys out there on the field in the clubhouse. He says, yeah, he says, I'll try it. And that he pitched. That was my greatest fame to baseball.
Well, that was that conversation with Sandy Koufax on that seventh game.
Yeah, it was a very short, few words, and he says, "Who's asking?" I said, "Player, these 25 or 30 guys in this clubhouse." And he went out there and pitched.
And pitched a shutout, 2-0 against.
What a pitcher! He lives, you know, he lives here.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, we play golf.
Oh, do you?
We talk, we converse. Yeah. Nice guy.
Well, that's
great conditioner. Outstanding basketball player.
And he was a very deeply religious man. He would not, I think that opening game of the World Series was Yom Kippur. And, I think generally he, you know, very observant about his religious beliefs, and like Hank Greenberg was when he played with the Tigers.
I can go to a story about this now. Back in Wrigley Field, Dr. Salk, the one that came up with the Salk vaccine.
Oh, the Salk vaccine.
For polio.
Mm-hmm.
We're playing, and the next day is a Jewish holiday. Holtzman against Koufax. Will not pitch. It's a Jewish holiday. Kenny Holtzman against Andy Koufax. This Dr. Salk comes around. I got to know him very casually, I think through Jack Brickhouse or somebody, Lou Boudreau maybe, and says, do you think you're going to ask Sandy Koufax to come to the synagogue? So I said, well, I'll ask him. Doctor, I said, I don't know if people are not. So I asked him, he said, you know, go to the synagogue. And he says, yeah. He said, I'm going to go. I said, well, Doctor Salk will pick you up at the hotel and whatever. I'm Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, you know, they're at the synagogue, and then after that day, the next day they pitch against one another. Well, Cole Holzman beats them 2-1.
Mm-hmm.
Won a few games that Colfax loses.
Yeah.
You know. So Dr. Salk comes over by my dugout and hands me a little package. And he says, this is asking Sandy to come to the synagogue. I don't know what it is. So I said, well, thanks. Appreciate it. You know, no mm-hmm. problem. So I go up in the clubhouse, open this thing up, and look, and there's Star of David. And I turn it over, St. Christopher on the other side. So that was my association with Dr. Salk.
So with Dr. Salk, that's
yep.
great.
Yeah. And Sandy.
You had some, as I said, in the mid-60s, had some fantastic pitchers. Don Drysdale, who I heard the expression along with throwing at Whitey Ford, they love to throw chin music.
Yeah.
Anytime they see a batter start digging in.
Mm-hmm. Well,
they would
that's the way they had to pitch. That's the way Don had to pitch. I mean,
they wouldn't allow that today, though, too much. They might have the players' union after him, wouldn't they?
Well, knowing how to do it is one thing, and doing it intentionally is another thing.
Well, yes. Okay.
Don Drysdale knew how to do it without injury to somebody.
And how's that?
Because Willie Mays would come up to play, and the first pitch, Willie Mays, his bats go flying, his helmet go flying, the pitch was nowhere near him.
Kind of made a fool of himself.
Well, he didn't make a fool of himself, but I think he knew the way it was going to happen. He said, well, why not now?
Why not now?
Ball might be right down the middle for what I know, you know. But he did it. And but it showed, hey, I'm in charge. I'm gonna be in charge of this game. And that's the way they went about their business.
And he loved that.
But there was nobody charging the mound. Like there is today. Frank Robinson got hit in the side I don't know how many times because he stayed on top of the plate and he would not give up the plate. And the pitcher says, well, if you're going to stand this close, I'm not going to hit you intentionally, but I'm going to pitch you inside. So he gets hit a few times, you know. But he never went out there and threw a bat at the pitcher or fought him or anything.
Yeah.
Hey, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. I think the one incident way back is when Lou Boudreau led the American League in hitting and he was crouched over the plate and led the league in hitting. I think he had like 350 or something as the manager shortstop of the Cleveland Indians, 1948 or whatever. And the pitcher said, you're going to have to move away from that plate or you're going to get hit. So Mr. Boudreau moved away from the plate and didn't hit as well, but he didn't get hit either.
Because he didn't have any welts.
Because you have to give the pitcher something.
But Dreist always had the feeling it was like Lou Burdett. He loved that duel. There was just something.
Oh, yeah.
When that batter got up, he loved that duel one-on-one.
One-on-one. It has to be that way with a pitcher, though.
You think every pitcher has that instinct?
Oh, no, but to be a good pitcher, the better half. You have to have that. You have to have that early win or Virgil Trucks or Whitey Ford or Ollie Reynolds. All the good pitchers. They've got that something in their eyeball.
Yeah.
I can name a lot of Kansas City players. They've got big bonuses. Sorrentino, right-handed pitcher, never really made it. Fellow by the name of Frank Hiller.
Yes, Frank Hiller.
So. But then they had that stare in his eyes and say, hey, I'm the boss. I'm the guy that scored that Steve Crawford.
Yeah, Steve Carlton and Garver was Gene Garver. You know, they come out and boy, you think they were mad at their own mother.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, they'd take that ball away from you
and
look at you as if they could tear you in half.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's
they wouldn't crack a grin for all the.
That's the tiger look, you know. That's the one. I love this situation. That's one on one, Dale.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm going to show my supremacy over.
Yeah.
Not that it works all the time, but...
Well, that's where...
You know, we call it... Fresco Thompson said, you can judge a player's ability. You can't judge his intestinal fortitude. There's no way to find out what he's got in his stomach, what he's got in his heart. His ability is there.
Yes.
Pitchers can pitch in their squad games. Players can come in spring training and hit 500. And when the season starts, they're entirely different. They can't function under pressure. And how do you find these things out? It's almost impossible.
Do it by trial and error, I guess.
Yeah.
That's why a lot of people go up and a lot of people come down.
That's why a lot of teams never reach the winning World Series or getting into World Series, never winning pennants.
Mm-hmm.
The scouts are good scouts. They scout good ball players. They see what they can do. They can see their abilities. But if that scout can't read that intestinal fortitude, can't read what's in that heart, then he hasn't signed a good ball player.
What kind of, what'd you look for in that invisible thing called heart?
Don't be agreeable. Don't always be agreeable.
What do you mean, don't always be agreeable?
I mean, when it comes to things of saying, don't be a yes man all the time. When a situation comes up, and you see this hitter going up the home plate, whether it's spring training or during the season, and he's not sure of himself, and you watch guys, they'll be looking back at the dugout. They'll look back into the dugout. They'll glance to see if you're sending a pinch hitter up for him. Well, you may as well.
Okay, when they have that second thought.
They've got my two little gypsies.
Yeah.
That's and, their look. That Tom Seaver look. You know, hey, there's another guy. I mean, he had that that stare, you know, that that winning type of attitude. Joe Morgan, when he goes to bat, you can shoot a cannon off and it wouldn't disrupt him in any way. I mean, his concentration would still be there. Johnny Bench, Mike Schmidt learned. Mike Schmidt wasn't like that at the beginning,
that's
but
right,
he learned. Dick Allen kind of helped that situation, I thought. Clemente, you know, not all the great ball players. There's a lot of guys who were just average ball players that had it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the Billy Martin, you know.
he was a
fierce competitor.
You bet.
You know, he challenged a bull coming in. He'd be a great matador, Al. He'd probably fight him without a sword. It wouldn't matter.
He'd come in sliding high on second base.
Oh,
and,
yeah. What's fair is fair. That's where baseball has changed, I think. Frank Robinson going to second base, he would never try to hurt anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd go straight into second base. But he'd try to break up a double play.
Yes.
Today, if you do that, you got a big fight.
Yeah, that's right.
Pitchers.
I'll see you later.
Okay.
Pleasure meeting you.
That little things like that, you know, they kind of disrupt my thinking about baseball today. It's still the same game and all that, and yet it's changed a lot.
Well, you had a Maury Wills in 65 that stole 60 or 94 bases, broke the, I don't think the record was broken right then. You had players that broke that, of course, and Ricky Henderson breaking the all-time record.
Mm-hmm.
Did he have kind of the green light to steal whenever he wanted to, independent
yes.
of the game, of what was happening in the game?
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of where it started, right then and there, wasn't it?
The kind of team we had in Los Angeles in 65, you know, when we got two runs, we got a lot of runs. I mean, we were joyful because our pitching was so great and our defense was so good.
That's right.
We never really blew anybody away.
You didn't have the home run hitters.
No. Ron Fairley.
Yes.
At Wes Parker, Jim Lefevre, who was a rookie, had a good year. Lou Johnson, who came in because Tommy Davis broke his ankle.
Mm-hmm. And did real well in the World Series.
Yes, very well. And I can remember just one game we played in Milwaukee, against Milwaukee, in Milwaukee. And this is the latter part of the season in September. Sandy Koufax started this game, and he got shelled for the first time. I can't remember him ever getting hit as hard as he did. I think he left the game in the second or third inning, losing 9-0 or 9-1 or something like that. And we won that ball game. Mm-hmm. Eventually won it. And then we went on to win the pennant in 65. But from that day, from that game on, is when we went on a streak of winning, I guess, 10 of 11 or something like that. We eventually beat Milwaukee on Saturday against Tony Clonger. Koufax beat him that day. We won the National League Championship. But we had Ron Peronoski in the bullpen, you know. Mm-hmm. He had a great year.
That's right. He was a stopper.
He came in there, and Bob Miller was in there, you know, and these things kind of worked out. A lot of guys, Howie Reed was on that team, and nobody gave Howie Reed much thought.
He was fantastic. He did a beautiful job in relieving that year.
He pitched a game against Cincinnati where he gave up 4 home runs, and we won 5-4. And he was the only guy we knew. He was the only pitcher we had. It was a doubleheader, I think. But he gave up 4 home runs. I remember Frank Robinson hit one, and Vida Pinson, and Wally Post, I think, was on that team. He hit one. He gave up 4. You know, it looked like we're dead ducks, but we ended up winning 5-4.
Tell you, for a pitcher to keep his cool after 4 home runs. And
we played in that little ballpark, you know. Cincinnati had a little bandbox.
That's right. That's,
but, gosh, Cincinnati, you know, Kozlowski, I think, he was on that team. I know Vada Pinson was on it. Cardenas was on it. Roy Post. Frank Robinson. Bob, I don't know if Bailey was on there.
I don't know. I'd have to check.
Catcher?
I don't remember. That would put the fear in a few managers when they see
they hit that ball out of the ballpark, you know, like flies. I mean, shoot. And give up 4 runs wasn't too much in that ballpark. You know, you figure you're going to give up that many anyway. Mm-hmm.
Did you, serving under Walt Alston, later elected to the Hall of Fame, he was a rather quiet, reserved man. He never really, he never talked about his players, that is, anything personal. He kept that within himself and between the players.
Right.
You have been associated with a number of people like that throughout your baseball career, that same kind of style that you also accepted as a manager and coach.
I think that's, I probably got that from him too, you know, where whatever they do personally off the field, whatever they do on the field, we leave it here. I don't discuss it. And I think this is why I got in a little trouble in Philadelphia with the writers about a lot of these things. And whether they understood it later on or not, I don't know. But I felt that way. I'll continue to feel that way. What, if I have a problem here with my children, I'm sure not going to go out and tell everybody outside.
Keep that in the family.
Keep it right there in the family without embarrassing someone.
Dan, I could spend 5 more hours with you, but
I could too.
I can only say, if you would like to continue this, I'll be pleased to come up at your pleasure. But let me ask you this, because we never have gotten to the Phillies, really. And then I think about your returning to the Dodgers, and they had a fantastic infield. You know, Ron Say and Steve Garvey and
Bill Russell
and Davey Lopes.
Davey Lopes, yes.
I think that was the... In Major League history, that stayed together as an infielder longer than any other group.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I can stop at this point and say, of all the articles written about you, what do you think is missing?
Missing? Oh gosh. I think that
they kind of hit it right on target about you, the sports writers and the players.
Well, I don't know whether they're not. I probably devoted more than a lot of people thought I was to baseball.
To the game.
Yeah.
As a student,
As perfectionist to the point of trying to get people to do more than they're capable of doing. What I thought they could do, and they thought maybe it was too much. But I was, Mike Schmidt was the one that, I call him a lunkhead, and I call him a bonehead. I try to get him to the point of fighting me. And
was he kind of timid when he came up? Awkward?
Yeah, he was, too nonchalant. Very nonchalant, like, nothing bothered him, but he kept it internally. He wouldn't come out and just say, "Gee, you know, why? I don't know why I can't do better."
He didn't trust his feelings in expressing them to others, though.
He just was so calm about it. You couldn't really upset him. You couldn't get him mad enough. They wanted to fire me because I kept him in 1973.
Mm-hmm.
He only hit 190 at that.
That's right.
But I saw something in the guy that I really admired. I thought he was going to be a great, outstanding ball player. Something that Fresco Thompson was talking about, and it's hard to explain.
Mm-hmm.
And these writers used to say, why, you know, what are you seeing? This is 73. See, I just see something, and it's hard to explain.
Okay. The same time you feel it, smell it.
Yeah. And he had a bad year. He had 190.
Mm-hmm.
He started off the season. He hurt his shoulder. He dove for a ball in spring training. Hurt his right shoulder. Mm-hmm. He couldn't. In fact, we were really scared about this thing. But it eventually came around, and I remember the first game that I put him into as a pinch hitter. Bob Gibson is pitching, and we're losing 2-1, I think, something like that. And I might go up and hit. He went up to hit. And I just hope he hits the ball.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. Well, he hits a home run. We win the ball game in the ninth inning. And that was kind of the beginning of, he used to say, "You're trying to be my father."
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I was. I was trying to protect him. I wouldn't play him against Tom Seaver.
Why?
I didn't want him to strike out. I didn't want him to hurt his ego.
Was it that fragile?
Yeah. He struck out. Tom Seaver struck him out like 7 straight times. And I said, "Well, I'm not going to play him this time. I'm going to keep him out." But he wanted to play.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Gee, I want to protect him." You know? Maybe I was wrong in doing that. I'm not sure. But in my own mind at that particular time, I said, "This is the right thing to do."
Mm-hmm.
The fans around him, you know, they're booing him and stuff like that. After that season was over, I talked to Paul Owens and Rudy Carpenter, and we're going to send him to Puerto Rico to play in the Winter League. Well, I hope he doesn't get released. That's a really kill. Billy DeMars is managing, going to manage down there for him. So we make a decision. Let's bring Mike Schmidt in to Philadelphia. And I'll work with him with his hitting. But he's stubborn, you know. He's stubborn as a mule. Okay. We bring him in for a week before he's supposed to go to Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
He comes in. Very reluctantly. I have a batting practice pitcher that we've used all summer. This guy's in shape. He can throw for almost an hour every day. We pay his expenses in. We feed him. We do everything for Mike. Because Rudy Carpenter wants to do it. And Paul Owens wants to do it through my insistence, kind of, because I like the guy. I know what he could do and all this stuff, you know. 2 days, he doesn't want to do anything. I can't do it this way. I can't do it your way and all this stuff. Third day, we come out to the ballpark. You know, and Rudy Carpenter says, "How's he doing?" I said, he doesn't want to do anything. Third day, he comes to the ballpark, get dressed. He says, "Okay, let's go." Just like a light going on and off. He said, let's go. He said, I'll do whatever you want me to do. Wow, you know, hey.
I'm all, man,
I'm going at it, you know, now. And I got this guy, we're out there, and we're working here, we're doing little things. Whatever I suggested, he tries, and he does them, you know. And the next day he comes on, we do the same thing. Now, 5 days have gone by. And he says, you know, I'd like to go home before I go to Puerto Rico. I said, okay, let's do it today, and you can go home tomorrow. You give him some time off. We were not doing work, you know, and he went back home, spent a couple of days with his family, his mother and father, and whatever, and went to Puerto Rico and had a hell of a year in Puerto Rico. Hit like, I don't know, 15 or 16 home runs in a short season. Hit the ball in the opposite field, which he couldn't do before. Not because of what I told him to do, it's because he just tried to do it. He was a good student. And season starts in 1974, has a good year. Outstanding. Hey, all of a sudden, this guy, yeah, he did see something. And, you know, that's what everybody's telling me. My general manager and the owner, Willie Carpenter, all the confidence in the world in what I was doing, and the players that we took, you know, on the team. And before you know it, I get let go, and I go to Los Angeles, and I go to San Francisco, and I retire. Mike Schmidt retires.
About 2 years ago.
Yeah, and we got up to Philadelphia, and they're going to retire Mike Schmidt's number 20. Because he retires, he's going to get in the Hall of Fame next year. Sure, it's bananas, you know. And we're there for the big shindig. He comes over, he gives me a big hug, which is fine. You know, we're on a field and all that, and I really enjoyed that.
What did he say to you?
You know, I don't remember exactly what he said.
Did he acknowledge what back in 70?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, he didn't acknowledge that, but I think he kind of understood what I was trying to do. Because now he's a father, too.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got two kids. And maybe I taught him something, not only for baseball, but something about his own family.
I interrupted you in the... you came up and he put his arms around you.
Yeah, we hugged, you know, and everybody, you know, all these people are out there in the stands, you know, watching.
Yeah.
And then some of the writers that were, you know, on the beat in 73 and all that when he was being crucified.
Mm-hmm.
Not by them and by other people.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of went back and said, gee, you know, we see, you know, what happened and how it went about. All these things that were said before.
Mm-hmm.
Which a mistake is, it's a mistake. Everybody makes mistakes, you know. And he turned out to be a good kid, but Greg Luzinski was a great guy on that team.
The Bull.
Larry Bull, Bobby Boone, Bake McBride.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, a lot of people didn't understand Bake McBride. They said, he'll never play, he doesn't want to play.
Mm-hmm.
Bake McBride was one of the greatest guys I had.
He did it so casually and with such grace that people thought he wasn't hustling.
Yeah, and he, you know, they said, you know, he doesn't put out. He became an outfield hitting coach for the New York Mets. And the kids loved him. Because he was so easygoing, nonchalant, really went on to help kids out.
Mm-hmm.
Just had a great guy. Gary Maddox, the same way.
Yes.
Gary Maddox said, oh, hey, you don't want to do this. You don't want to play. Never gave me a problem. I don't know. That's what some things I don't understand about, you know, baseball people saying, this guy won't play. They played for me. And they like to play for me. I just had Timmy McCarver. Played for him. He said some things bad about me, but I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
He played for me.
Well, McCarver, he still talks a lot too much broadcasting baseball games, but that's another another story.
Yeah. But we had a lot of fun.
How'd you deal with Steve Carlton? I mean, a quiet, he almost seemed like angry.
I understood his problem very well. It got into a personal problem with the writers.
Yeah, I know. And he wouldn't talk to them maybe even to this day.
He talked to a couple writers.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. Ray Kelly was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Ray that passed away. He worked for the New Jersey.
Do things like that breed dissension or conversation on the team?
No.
No. That's kind of something separate and that's individual.
I think the educational part of the whole thing was that we had some guys that were well educated and could understand these things. And I think they're using that now to help Greg Lucinski's a football coach and a baseball coach working for nothing at a high school. And he loves it. He's got a son that's going to be a good ball player. He's going to be number one choice in the country.
What's he live out of Jersey?
I hear that he's going to go to Miami school.
Have Lazinski
great
down there.
Football player.
He's built like his father.
He's bigger than his father. I mean, taller. He's a little taller, but he weighs about, he probably weighs 225.
Less than his father.
And he's a catcher.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, his father only weighed about 205 when he played for me.
Oh, really?
Begin with 1973.
I guess I think when he went over to the White Sox and
gained
that weight.
Well, 76, 77, 78 for me, he was about 225. But whether he was 225 or not, he didn't change. He was just a good guy.
He was just a good guy.
When I went back to Los Angeles as a coach, I coached there for 3 years.
And won another World Series, 4-2 against the Yankees.
It was,
and that was we
another,
were
down.
We
that's
were right,
down,
another, you know. That was another series where you were down by two games and won four straight.
Yeah. That's when Fernando had the great year, for us. And
I saw that.
First year of Sachs, that was the beginning of the Sachs. Steve Sachs.
Oh, was that his first year?
Played in the World Series.
Oh, I see.
Took Davey Lopes' place. And that was the breakup of the...
infield there for 7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
Dan, as I said, I could stay here through the evening and enjoy dinner with you and have breakfast tomorrow morning, but I know you have other obligations, so I guess we should stop here. And I thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
I have 2 inches of articles and questions that I never got around to asking you.
I know.
But perhaps another time.
Can't cover 42 years in an hour.
That's
and
right.
A half.
But perhaps another time, if you are willing to do that, we can have part two.
Yeah, this is great. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you very much.
Government organization for national security, even as we set off to go tinker with a lot more change. I think Ronald, the problem is the narrow definition. It began when we put the structure in place, diplomacy, size, and deployment of our principles. Then with the Marshall Plan, we added foreign aid, and then another decade later, we added arms control.